And we've had this conversation before, and it has taken us a while to complete CAMS and get the peer review done. It took us longer than we anticipated. But we have the peer review now. And when that says we start using that system, that will be the pathway that we use EM data and assessments for discovery.
Okay, thank you. I have Mr. Salerno, then Ms. Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Cadron. This is a very helpful presentation to kind of collate this. And obviously, this has developed some really fruitful discussion around the table here for us. One of the things that, you know, going through your presentation, the way you put it together, I appreciate it. Actually, I'm looking at slide 13 where recommendations 5, 6, and 7. Those are three of the recommendations that I've participated in for almost 20 years or so. So I would like to kind of speak to those, you know, prioritizing improving catch accounting. While the sector, groundfish sector program has its warts and flaws and what have you, I think one of the benefits of the sector system is that there are roughly, what, 7, 8, or 9 of us sector managers that have, in my opinion, greatly improved the catch accounting of the groundfish fishery. Yes, there has been some issues with misreporting, what have you. But I think overall, what we have contributed as outside entities into the process of catch accounting and groundfish has made the real near real time, whatever the phrase is, accounting of the groundfish fishery in basically real time has probably come leaps and bounds since the pre-sector system. So I'm not saying developing a sector system type for all our management plans, but it's just a concept of having an outside set of eyes. I mean, really what I see as my role as a sector manager is I'm finding data errors long before the agency. And I'm not saying that the agency doesn't find them as well, but I think the sector managers are looking at this data in such a time frame that we are catching these errors long before it gets to the agency side. You know, this focus on cooperative research, obviously SMAS and CLF had a small get together, I believe 2 weeks ago, talking about how cooperative research could help the groundfish industry. And one of the things that bubbled up in that discussion was, I think kind of was highlighted in your presentation, lack of sampling, the number of port samples that are going down. And one of the things that came out of that discussion, I don't want to jump ahead, but you know, it should come out in the documents you guys provide from that meeting, is that the industry is willing to collect samples, whatever you need. We you know, and it's not just the commercial industry. I think Mr. Pierdnock was there, and he showed that they were collecting, the recreational fishery was collecting mackerel samples, I believe, for, you know, some entities to use in their modeling. So there is a whole wealth of boats out there willing to collect these samples in a very cost-effective manner. What I see we as, when I refer to we, is the industry, the commercial and the recreational fisheries, we need guidance. What do you need from the Science Center? The what, the when, the where, the why, you know, and by species. And we can get that for you. I'm not saying everyone would participate, but I don't think you need 5,000 gonads, but you know, what do you need that we can provide? And on the flip side of that, we as an industry also need that commitment that these samples will actually be processed and used. You know, we're not just going to bring you stuff and it's going to sit in a freezer. So it's just kind of thinking about this cooperative research component, that there needs to be that other end of actually using the information that's being collected. And as to this new technology, I think Mr. Smith's discussion here kind of highlights, just because we have a new technology doesn't mean it's going to save us. You know, EM, some of my boats have had cameras on there since 2010. You know, it's been a long time to develop at least the audit model program that I've been involved with. And yet 12 years later, we're still not using the data. So these new technologies, and I have to go back to a comment I heard many years ago at some EM presentation, that these new technologies are not the shiny baubles. It's just another tool, and we have to make sure we develop a proper way to use the tool and actually use the information coming out of these tools. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't look into new technologies, but it's not just here you go, have at it. You know, there's a lot of information that needs to go into just developing these tools and getting them into implementation and into the process. But that's what I have for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Ms. Griffin, then Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I had some thoughts that are a little bit more general in terms of our managing through the ecosystem uncertainty. And when Dr. Kadron was presenting on that and remarking about, you know, we can address that and account for that in SOC assessment, he said something that really jumped out at me, and that's the, you know, when those changes are going to persist. And I think that's a particularly sticky wicket we have. Who decides how and when? We need transparency and improved understanding around those productivity changes, and in particular, you know, for us, when those changes trigger revised reference points or even more dynamic reference points. You know, there's been some movement on that. I know at one point fairly recently in GARFO, there was some discussion about reviewing any discrepancies in advice on short and long-term projections. That was particularly with respect to, you know, some revisions in the recruitment understanding. I don't recall if that feedback loop was closed with the council. And, you know, there's just a whole host of other concerns around stationarity assumptions, whether that's the current policy on status determination when stock status is unknown. You know, I know we have the state space modeling coming up, but I think the default there is still stationarity assumptions. So there's just so much under that particular aspect of managing under uncertainty. And there's various entities that are addressing it, but I think we need to continue our education, engagement, and explicit understanding of how we're not just going to manage under ecosystem uncertainty, but how we're going to attempt to reduce that uncertainty. This is certainly something that Dr. Sissonwine has stressed numerous times. There's so much momentum in the system, and it's going to take sustained effort to address that. And I just want us to keep that in our heads. And I know I need, I could use a lot more engagement on that.
Thank you, Ms. Griffin. Mr. Hansen, then Mr. Belavance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Kadron, for such a great presentation. Models are only good as their inputs. So there's a lot, that's where the uncertainty comes in. Surveys are done seasonally. They're done with decreased efficiency recently because of cost cuts. What role does CPUE play in reducing uncertainty? I know it won't work with a stock, a multi-species stock, because there are choke species and fishing effort shifts, but specifically to the monkfish fishery. You know, our climate's changing, seasonal migrations change, but our surveys are still the same season. They're not following the seasonal change. And I think the big concern right now, especially in the monkfish fishery, is that the seasons are changing and the surveys are not seeing the fish. Can the CPUE play a role in stock assessments and reducing uncertainty?
So, Chair, if you'd like, I can answer that. I'll answer that as the chair of the Fishery Data for Assessment Working Group, and we addressed exactly that question. Our recommendation was CPUE should be considered in all assessments, not necessarily as a stock index in the model, but even including it in the assessment helps to understand the information coming from fishery monitoring, the perspectives of fishermen, of what their catch rates are, and potentially it can be an informative index of abundance. And we've been implementing that recommendation in recent groundfish assessments, particularly, you know, one of our best assessments, scallops, has plenty of surveys. And so probably the need for fishery catch rates is not there. But as you know, you're collaborating in it. Landings punitive effort is an important part of the days at sea decision. And so the fishery catch rates are used there operationally as part of it. And so I think there's enough success stories of using CPUE in assessments that it's worth trying. And without having looked at the monkfish data, I'd say in principle, there may be something there that's worth exploring, as long as the expectations are managed that there may be good reasons that it's not a good index of abundance. But I think due diligence is needed before you can answer that question.
Oh, thank you very much.
Hey, very good. Mr. Belavance, then Mr. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Kadron, for your presentation. It was super informative. So it's hard to talk about uncertainty and not think about recreational catch estimates and how that impacts the way we manage the stocks that have a recreational component to them here in New England. And I find my head spinning a lot of times trying to think of ways to make that better. We have a national data collection program that's been peer-reviewed and is considered the best available way to collect data from the recreational fishery. But I make some observations in that it seems like there are species that it does do a pretty decent job of collecting data, but then other species or stocks that it doesn't do as good. And maybe that's a product of sample size or things like that. But at the end of the day, we're still trying to make management decisions with these huge uncertainty parentheses around a point estimate. And I'm struggling, and maybe this is a question for everybody here, is there a way to develop tools that we could look at the MREP data on a stock by stock or species by species basis and develop different risk parameters based on the uncertainty around those data and offer some more flexibility in how we manage those recreational fisheries, because we're getting ourselves wound around an axle on something that pretty much everybody agrees is not really accurate in some cases, but yet I think we're forced to use it. And I don't know if anyone else around the table has given any thought into different approaches to take. And maybe there's crickets here, but I'm hoping not. I mean, I think about it a lot and I can't come up with anything. So curious if you or others have any thoughts.
Yeah, just quickly, I agree with you. You know, so our recreational estimates are better for some species than others. And it may be that they were designed to estimate things like striped bass catch better because that's primarily a recreational fishery. It may be because the patterns of striped bass fishing are just conducive to sampling. There are others, as you know, things like Southern New England cod, where it provides estimates, but at times they're uncertain estimates, you know, things like wave one that we're in right now when there's a cod fishery in Southern New England. We don't have length sampling. So there are some gaps there for these, I guess, secondary recreational stocks, that they're not primarily recreational. And the solution there may be something similar to what Dan Salerno said, is that supplementing MRIP with dedicated cooperative sampling. I think winter sampling the cod, winter cod fishery would be a topic that could, I think, fairly cost-effectively supplement MRIP to improve at least the size structure. And so supplementing for these secondary recreational species may be needed to reduce the uncertainty.
Mr. Penny.
Yeah, thanks. It's a good question, and thanks, Dr. Cater, for your thoughts as well. I mean, I think, you know, specifically Mr. Bellavance's question is exactly what we're trying to do in the Mid-Atlantic Council with the recreational harvest control rule approach that the council has completed on and the agency is still reviewing, but we expect to be able to implement that this year. So it might, you know, if the council would consider this, maybe once we've made a final decision and kind of have a rule out for the harvest control rule approach, if this council would like kind of a briefing to explain how it functions, and then that could initiate a conversation. Is it something, or are there elements of that that could be applied to recreational cod and haddock? That might be worth a discussion. Thanks.
Mr. Nice.
Yeah, I think Mr. Pentney's suggestion is a good one. You know, we did try a few years ago, I think back around 2015, we asked the recreational advisory panel for advice on how to simplify and streamline and improve our recreational management approach. And after, Jamie's not in the room yet, I don't think, but my recollection is after 4 or 5 months, the RAP basically said, we're happy with the way we are. Or perhaps a better way to put it is, I think they said, we really don't have a better idea right now. And so, you know, there are things we do. We adjust measures every year, for example. And, you know, that was a council choice to establish that, but that causes this complicated discussion like we're going to have this afternoon, I think, about, you know, what the rec measure should be in any given year. So, you know, I do think it might be a good idea once the MIDS action is done to take a look at it and to see if there are some ideas to follow up on there. You know, I mean, I've heard people say, well, why don't we average our recreational catch for measuring against the ACLs? That's actually in the regulations now. That was already adopted by us years ago. So, but when this, with this annual adjustment, we don't really do that because those are proactive measures.
Okay, thank you. I have Mr. Hughes, then Mr. Pierdenock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody. Thanks, Steve. Great presentation. I really, really got a lot out of it. You know, I know that it kind of following on Mr. Salerno's comments, industry is more than willing to help and provide samples. And you, I know for a fact that you've been part of SEMFIS and some of the projects that they've worked on in the past. And maybe one of the data limited projects we worked on was the chub mackerel project, where industry provided a lot of chub mackerel samples for a very data limited, for us anyhow, in the United States and the East Coast of the United States, for us, which was very data limited fishery. Industry provided those samples. Advice came out of SEMFIS that worked its way into management. The council then went out and hired a contractor to find out some other information about what HMS species were working in a predator-prey relationship. So industry, Elex is another species example that I can give you where industry has provided surf clams, ocean quahogs also. So industry is more than willing to work with you, and I'm just really, really appreciative of this presentation here today. It's a very teaching presentation, not telling presentation. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Mr. Pierdenock, then Ms. Ware.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. Kagan, for your presentation. And just to expand upon what's been said, I kind of look at it two different ways. We have this issue with observations on the water and then inconsistency with the outcomes when you run the models. And that's where the rec for hire and commercial community come in, that data and landings and releases and so on has to be looked at. I look at it more from a lines of evidence approach, that if the lines of evidence are such that that's needed for the data gaps, then please consider that for use to make a fishery management decision. We'd be more than willing, the rec and for hire community, to participate in this process and cooperative research to provide the data and information of the observations on the water. In many instances, the recreational for hire community are at the forefront of these observations with shifting stocks and increased water temperatures and so on, especially where the commercial fleet may not be able to fish within those areas. So somehow we need to integrate that data and information in for use. And we, as was stated earlier, we look there and say, please tell us what you need so we can help as part of that process. So that's one part of it. Next part of it is as noted, we continue to have this issue with MRIP data. And I do agree, there's been other examples where the MSC and hazard control rule process has been used as a way to try to address those environmental issues as well as inconsistencies with MRIP. So that hopefully could be food for thought for cod or haddock in the future, because I suspect when we If we go to that five cod structure type of approach, we already can see where there's going to be issues with MRIP and other things that maybe that's where that would be the need to integrate that into the process to try to adjust that. That's it. No, thank you.
Okay, Ms. Ware, and then I'm going to go out to the audience.
Thank you. Maybe to change topics just a little bit here and talk about communicating uncertainty. I feel like a lot of our discussion so far has been about how do we reduce uncertainty or how do we account for it? And that's a very important discussion. But I think in terms of like a takeaway from today, my takeaway is that's potentially very expensive, time consuming, and like a pretty big challenge. And I think like potential pretty cheap win today would be talking about communicating uncertainty and like what we can do to better communicate it. So I've just been actually going through some stock assessment figures. I think as managers, we're probably notorious for focusing mostly on the SSB and the F figures, but I've noticed that some of them have confidence bounds and some of them do not. I mean, for me, I think that is like an easy fix that we could make to better communicate uncertainty as our first point. And I think I pulled up the Spiny Dogfish and Bluefish presentation for tomorrow. One of them has it, one of them doesn't. I mean, that is like a pretty easy fix that we could take away from today. So I would just maybe like throw out there, what can we do to better communicate uncertainty? And as a follow-up to today's discussion, I think it may be helpful for the council to have a session on how do we read uncertainty in stock assessments, and not just from the SSB and the F figures, but you know, from like length at age or you know whatever else is in there that we look at. I think generally we could do better as a council at reading uncertainty in an assessment, and then start the conversation about okay, how do we address that uncertainty,
Mr. Nice.
So, you know, that's an interesting question and an interesting point. But, you know, one of the problems I always have with the stock assessment uncertainty is that, one, what is it actually measuring when we get that? And maybe, I don't know if Steve can address that as not or not. You know, model uncertainty is a question. I'm going to use an apocryphal story. I remember talking to one of the stock assessment scientists asking whether the CVs around the survey indices that they use in the stock assessment take into account the error in the length weight calibration from Bigelow to Albatross. And his answer was no. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, if we did that, a model would never fit. You know, I'm thinking, well, that's not, you know, this was over a beer. He was being funny, but you know, I'm not sure he was wrong. But then the other issue that I have sometimes is, we see these levels, which are scientific, which say there's this error bound, but then there's a legal determination that you have to meet that is based on, at least I think it is, usually the median approach. And I guess the question for the agency, is there any flexibility for how you evaluate things like overfishing, given the uncertainty in a stock assessment, or whether it's overfished? You know, I think it's Whitehake where we got down to the, you know, with the row adjustment, it was at 49.5% of SSBMSY, so it was still overfished assessment ago. I mean, you know, if you looked at the uncertainty around that estimate, I'm sure it overlapped, but I guess that's really my question with the agency. When we communicate uncertainty, then what does the council do with it if you're going to rely on a point estimate?
Dr. Hare.
Thank you. I was going to respond to Mrs. Ware's comment. So I don't have an answer for you, Tom, because I need to think about your question after I answer Megan's question. So, yeah, I mean, that's on us at the Science Center, right, to try to have, you know, more standard outputs, and sort of the comparison between dogfish and bluefish is an excellent one. So thank you for making that comment, and we can sort of maybe work. I'm not sure who would be best to work with, maybe with the SSCs or try to sort of standardize sort of the information, particularly in the research track assessment. So thank you. And then as Tom, as to your point about, you know, how does uncertainty work in overfishing and or overfish determinations? I can't answer that right now. I don't know if you have a comment, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have an answer, but I think it is something worth looking at, because I think there is a way to get at what, you know, Tom's point. I think it depends on, and you know, I'll give the lawyer's answer, it depends on how the council ultimately writes the status determination criteria. If the status determination criteria is written as measure a point estimate against a point, you know, against a specific number, then yeah, you're going to be bound to that point estimate. But if you write the criteria in such a way that takes into account variability over, say, a 3-year period, and you could write the metric to look at the error bars and take that into account, then I think there's a way that you would end up with an objective measure that could be evaluated on a you know, routine basis that would inform whether overfishing is occurring. Because again, overfishing under the Magnuson Act is a kind of a long-term thing that threatens the long-term viability and productivity of the stock. So it doesn't have to be something that you only look at 1 year at a time. So I think there are ways to do that. It's just we'd have to work through it and develop different criteria than the ones we generally use.
Mr. Nice.
Yeah, I don't want to sound argumentative, but I mean, those ideas seem to butt up against some legal determinations we've had, which have concluded, for example, that you have to have no less than a 50% probability of overfishing or being, I don't know about overfished, but overfishing. So, you know, that's the disconnect that I see there, that we sometimes have to meet those as well.
Go ahead, Mitch. Since I was invoked when Mr. Prentney referred to it depends, I agree with both Tom and Mike on this one. Yeah. So I'm taking the middle around. Well, ultimately, we need to stand before a court, right, and to be able to explain that our decision is not bent, it's not run over into bizarro world. And the bizarro world case was a case that relied on that 50% mark. So I agree that the council can have a robust discussion on uncertainty and have bounds and have a fulsome discussion of that within a particular record. When it comes to the agency, we need to be able to at some point meet that point standard, right? That bizarro world standard. How we get there though, it could be different. And so I personally don't want to be in front of a judge and over that 50% mark because it was a clear case, right? How it's described, how you know you take into account variations and contingencies as a national standard, could be worth pursuing and developing as Mr. Pentney has described. Okay, thank you, Mitch. Dr. Cadron, do you want
to? Yeah, I guess I'd like to bring this back to what Megan was suggesting, and that is clearly communicating uncertainty. And I think reporting confidence limits is a great technique to continue, and I think it could be standardized among assessments. Tom is right that those confidence limits are an underestimate of the total uncertainty. However, they can still be informative relative. If you were to compare spiny dogfish to bluefish, which one is more uncertain than the other, that's probably reasonable to do that. That the most recent years of the bluefish assessment are less certain than previous, confidence limits would really help you to do that. Those confidence limits still rely on accurate assumptions. They imply that all the assumptions are correct, which sometimes they aren't. And I think that was Tom's point, is that sometimes we get bigger changes that are outside our confidence limits. And, you know, I understand that the legal system requires some hard and fast values, but there are many industries that have legal approaches to risk where it doesn't need to be black and white.
Are you all set, Megan?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I'm just trying to think of like, what is our next step after today? What is our takeaway from today? I don't think we're going to solve recreational MRIP data or environmental challenges, all that. Like, what can we take away that's tangible today? And that's what I'm taking away.
We can also talk about it tomorrow as well. So, okay. I'd like to go to the audience. Yes, sir. And if you could help me out and try to keep you 3 minutes, I'd really appreciate it. But I'd like to hear what you have to say. Come on up, Mr. Raymond.
Uh, I'll be real brief, but I just want to say that I heard it mentioned earlier, and I think catch per unit effort absolutely has to be taken into account in stock assessments. I can give you many examples, but I'll just give you one for now that's pretty concrete in my mind. With monk fishing, I keep hearing in the science, they're like, oh, the catch is down, the catch is down. And I'm like, yeah, in the north, at least, there's only a handful of guys that are even doing a directed monkfish fishery. So, you know, we're not going to catch what the fleet used to catch. It's there's hardly any fishermen left, you know, and there's, like I said, there's many more examples of that. But I just think CPUE absolutely has to be looked at in the science, in the stock assessments. I think without it, you're missing such a key piece of data. So thank you.
Thank you. I have anybody else in the audience? Anybody online? I have Ms. Lorenz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Allison Lorenz with Conservation Law Foundation. I just want to go back to the suggestion that the regional administrator made about the council considering the Mid-Atlantic's recreational harvest control rule. And I just want to express some concerns from CLF about that control rule. We filed a letter on the proposed rule that I'm happy to circulate to the council. And we're concerned because the Congress prescribed annual catch limits as a mandatory tool for use in all federal fisheries. And we're concerned that the Mid-Atlantic's rule will decouple management of recreational fishing from annual catch limits and will actually serve as a de facto form of reallocation between sectors. I'll just leave it at that for now, since you're not actually considering the control rule at this moment. But again, I'll be happy to share that letter with folks. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Mr. Wayne, then Ms. Tooley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks to the council. Honestly, this has been one of the best discussions about this topic that I've heard, and I would actually encourage other councils to put this on their agenda. Anyways, I just wanted to, you know, I appreciate Megan and others trying to think of kind of what is the takeaway here. And from the recreational fishing community standpoint, I think pretty much all stakeholders, managers, scientists at this point share some frustration in the recreational catch data. But what are the solutions to that issue? How do we improve it? How do we move it further, quicker? And I think one of the take homes for me was, is there an opportunity to prioritize research funding specific to the recreational catch accounting issue? And so I don't know if the agency has that kind of in the queue or if they do that already, but there just seems like this kind of, we're stuck in the mud and there could be improvements. What is limiting that? Is it money? If it's money, can we prioritize some of the research funding to address that? So I just appreciated this discussion and wanted to add that idea as the council moves forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Tooley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks very much. And I really have appreciated this question, the questions that have been raised in the discussion. And thanks very much for teeing this off, Dr. Catering. I did want to know if Steve, if you could go to the slide that made the recommendations from the 2018 council review, particularly the one about, perhaps workshops going forward. And the reason I raise that is because You know, it's a very difficult concept, and I think that, you know, coming in as new council members or new SSC members, you know, there's a couple of things. One is, you know, how well do I understand the subject matter at hand, and then do I understand my role in decision making relative to that subject? And it's evolving continuously. So if you're, you know, new in the system in either body, or you've actually been there for a long period of time, that's always a continuing learning process. And I think having presentations at the council is extremely helpful. But, you know, in something like this that has such depth, actually, you know, taking time, being subject specific and spending half a day, a full day, or something to that extent could really be helpful. And I just wanted to note that, because I think you're winding down on this agenda item today. But going forward, I think I would hope the council would consider this recommendations made here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tooley. Okay, I don't see anybody else from the public, so why don't we go back to the council. Ms. Etree.
Thank you. I have a comment that's slightly teed off of what's the tangible takeaway, and then I also have an additional question for Dr. Cadron. So the comment as what the tangible takeaway for me as it relates to uncertainty is, first and foremost, I would say is, a council body, we need to have a better understanding of uncertainty, including the intricacies of things such as data that goes into stock assessments, because when we make decisions, and I'll point to Amendment 23 as a perfect example, we aspire to improve data for stock assessments. We make the assumption that increased monitoring or electronic monitoring will improve stock assessments. That's an aspirational goal. There's nothing wrong with it, but understanding the intricacies of the data inputs into our stock assessments and how that data may or may not short, mid, long-term impact getting into those assessments is really critical to that aspirational goal, and also to informing stakeholders about what it is we think we're going to achieve in the mid, short, long-term. So I think as a council, we need to better understand uncertainty and how it factors into not just the outputs we get, but some of the goals we establish so that we can better communicate that to folks when we're making decisions. So that's one of my tangible takeaways from this. Also, the takeaway is I see uncertainty playing key roles into development of a risk policy, you know, risk policy work, our ABC control roles, a lot of the foundational documents that we use to drive our decisions moving forward. So those are some of my takeaways. And what I would say, like question-wise to Steve, thinking about ABC control roles is we have a priority for groundfish specific to revisit ABC control rules. So I'm not going to ask you to comment specifically to uncertainty to groundfish, but how could we, you know, just generally from your experience, think about uncertainty when developing ABC control rules moving forward?
Doctor?
Yeah, I'll take a quick swing at that. Is that when I was on the SSC and we were transitioning to ACLs, we quickly found out that the uncertainty in many groundfish assessments was not captured by that confidence interval, that the precision estimates coming out of the model were underestimates such that they didn't perform well. To have a risk-based ABC did not perform. And so I'll refer to some analyses that Dr. Kerr led on evaluating groundfish control rules that gave a more comprehensive measure of uncertainty with respect to catch bias or retrospective error or inaccurate model assumptions. Those are the types of analyses that will be needed to fully consider uncertainty in the performance of groundfish control rules. It's not going to be as simple as scallop assessment and using the precision that comes out of that.
Thanks.
Okay, very good. Well, I see no more hands from the council, so I'd like to thank the Doctors Cube, that would be Cadron, O'Keefe, and Kerr, for their work on this. And it's a great conversation. I thank the council and the public for engaging this morning. So with that, why don't we take a break until 10:40, and we'll get started with Monkfish. Thanks again, Doctor.